I must work. I must go forward. The mission which we have to fulfill is now shown to me. I see so clearly now, whereas before I saw as in a glass darkly. Now I see you and all men face to face. Most of all I see myself. I thank God for the many opportunities he gave me to help my fellow men. I see certain things in which I was mistaken. No man can have the entire truth. In some respects I was misled. Before my passing I had some suspicions regarding astral memories, and was aware that certain spiritualistic phenomena were attributable to these memories. But I did not believe that all such communications arose from this cause, nor do they. I tell you definitely that it is possible for the human spirit, which is the real man, if that man has a definite mission to perform for the good of humanity, to come back to execute it and so help forward the evolution of the race. Survival of the human soul is a proven fact, is unquestionable. But the world is waiting for a greater demonstration and a more evident proof of this mighty truth. Humanity must realize that communication with astral memories left behind by a soul after its passing and with the real spirit of a man are vastly different. Before any true communication can take place, it is necessary for the spirit of the person left behind on earth to be raised to the consciousness of spiritual reality. This is why so much is futile in the spiritualistic movement today. But the glorious truth of survival must be given to humanity in clear and perfect form. Personal responsibility and the redeeming power of love, these are the great things. A man's personal responsibility is an irrefutable fact, for I find that it is not only a man's actions in the outer world which count, but his inmost thought. This is because the spirit world to which he will go is a world of thought, his own thought, an internal state rather than an external condition in which he lives. Thought promotes action, the actions of each man again promote thought in his fellows, and we thereby return again to the thought world. Truly is it said that as a man sows he shall surely reap. In a broad sense the seeds of thought that he sows are interpreted as actions, but now I find that thought is more powerful than action. Since one of the first things a man is faced with on his escape from earth life is a world of his own thought. Let us pass on from this condition to the next, but not forgetting that it is not always pleasant to be isolated in a world which represents all the thoughts one has projected during a lifetime. But God is love, wisdom and justice. I would not have it otherwise. For it has been revealed to me in a most marvelous way how the love of God can manifest in the deepest heart of his children. Personal responsibility and the redeeming power of love, this one great lesson I have learned, and pass it on to all of you. No man can really live or die apart from God. God, Christ, love, call it what you will. The men of earth have seen a supreme manifestation of that great power of love, expressed in one, no, in several personalities. A long pause ensued. The speaker had been under deep emotion and agitation throughout, and his power was now obviously flagging. He continued, "Yes, yes, yes. The redeeming power of love is supreme. I must conclude my message with this. Love. Not personal love. Impersonal. Love for all men. Now I see the great need of all men. Yes. The Master." White Eagle interposes, "I think we can help now, as our brother is not able to finish." White Eagle speaks, "This is Arthur S. birthday, his second birthday, and from now on he gathers an ever increasing power. Vibrations are very strong and he is overjoyed, although he says, 'Nonsense, I did not lose my head.' But when you are dealing with conditions which are entirely unusual, you will understand that these things happen. He is so full of enthusiasm and desire to serve, to work, to fight on and to win. He does so want it all on the level. He is sensible of your token of love and remembrance to his old body." This probably refers to flowers laid that morning on his grave. "He is much more satisfied with the new. I am to say that he gets younger and has now a new body strong and full of beans," he says. "What follows now you may think peculiar, but he was very fond of the living creatures in the woods and gardens around his old home, and of a pet squirrel. He still loves to come and watch its little ways, and is still friendly with it. His was always a heart full of love for the little people, so boyish, so simple, so big, honest and sincere with its desire to help. His one desire was to give proof and comfort to the broken-hearted. There is one more thing he wanted to say. He stands on my left amid a group of shining forms most beautiful to behold, and that was about the many prophecies of catastrophes to come which he received a year or two before his passing. He says, "Do you not see how linked up we are already with the new age? We have before us a mighty work. There must be a great effort put forward to help humanity in its crisis. We must therefore spread the truth, and in that way make preparation so that souls do not come over here to dwell in darkness and then fall back into..." No, he will not complete that sentence. A brief blessing or benediction completes the record of that day, spoken under conditions of extreme emotional strain. Already we see that the dominant urge of Arthur Conan Doyle, beyond even that of family and affection, was this imperative message waiting to be delivered, this mission to which all else must be subordinated. Arthur Conan Doyle managed to strike a keynote. He laid, as it were, a foundation on which all that followed was to be built when he used the words, "As a man sows, so he must surely reap." To this he added, "In a broad sense the seeds of thought that he sows are interpreted as actions, but now I find that thought is more powerful than action, since one of the first things a man is faced with on his escape from earth life is a world of his own thought." Page 58. Initials, and the material proof. It seems necessary here to break the continuity of Arthur Conan Doyle's message in order to define one or more of the terms employed, such as soul or the astral world. For what does the word soul mean? It means our self, that is, man's inner self apart from the body physical that we drag around, which demands nearly all our strength, time and energy to nourish, clothe, house, protect, transport from place to place, amuse and exercise, and 8 hours sleep in order to rest it every night. The soul is our self. We are apart from our body only when we are carried away from it by something which absorbs us, by music, poetry, flowers or scenery, by drama or the ballet, by deep meditation, aspiration or spiritual illumination. Then do we function in our soul. We are that soul in all the higher reaches of our being, and our memories, interests, enthusiasms, thoughts, feelings, aspirations comprise it. Sometimes we are all soul, full, but oftener when the body is sick, sorry and complaining, we are mostly body. Nevertheless, our soul is ourselves as we really are, and as we shall be after the death of the body when we shall first migrate to astral realms. Not that there will be anything very novel in our astral environment, since we go there every night when we fall asleep. Sleep being a little death, we are well practiced in dying, and in this fashion die 365 times yearly. With each new day we awake. With the same certainty we shall presently awake after death, since both sleeping and dying are natural functions of our being. Why then do we not remember anything about the astral places which we are said to visit during sleep? But we do. Though we store our knowledge in a different compartment, or department, of ourselves, away from the self of every day, we are often ignorant of the extent of our ignorance. We know hardly anything. For example, about this physical body. We don't know whether physical matter is real, or what electricity really is. The two may be very closely linked, who knows? We don't even know what our world looks like, because our physical senses have so narrow a range that there are colors we cannot see, sounds we cannot hear, scents we do not register. This being so, man has a distorted and incorrect impression of the world in which he lives. We are, however, aware that everything in it is in a state of vibration, and that we ourselves vibrate in accord with a host of other vibrations. This we believe and accept scientifically. We need therefore only one step further to believe that there are other vibrations around us, not necessarily physical but ethereal or astral. There are indeed astral worlds encompassing this, each in a differing state of vibration from coarser to finer. Encompassing is the word, for they are not distant planets like Mars or Venus, but are additional departments or colonies of this world, which they encase, much as an onion is encased by its various skins, and yet also interpenetrate our world with themselves, much as water soaks through a sponge. These astral worlds are mostly of a higher vibration than the physical, and therefore consist of a finer matter. Human life is less burdened since the astral body worn over there by man does not weigh down its wearer, but is a thing of beauty, health and joy. This is the Summerland beloved by spiritualists. Souls go there, souls being humans freed from the flesh but otherwise unchanged, and inhabit an astral body. They do not at once become greatly wise or spiritual. Rest and refreshment after that oils of their earth life is the first necessity. This they obtain, and they remain in the astral world while time slips past. Some will say this is too good to be true. Nothing is too good to be true. Therefore it is perhaps a pity willfully to believe, habitually to believe, in things too bad to be true, of which there are many varieties, most of which are only bogies. But if people find this makes them happy, well, why not? What matters to us is that the astral worlds are very close to us always, because they interpenetrate our world and even influence our daily life, whether we are conscious or unconscious of the fact. Because these worlds are so close, the majority of spiritualistic contacts are with people of the astral, who are little changed from their former selves, except that their life is more serene than ours, less limited, less burdened, and their world more beautiful. They are not greatly wise, and their message lacks power. Great things are not demanded of those living in the restful Summerland. There is, unfortunately, another side to the picture. We have considered the higher astral worlds, or planes, to be more accurate. But what of those of a slower, of a lower vibration, perhaps even lower than this earth? These are not pleasant places, for they are peopled by humans whose lives have attuned them to such planes. They are grey, misty, dark, November, fog places, good to get out of. That is why they exist, to spur their folk to get away, by their own spiritual efforts. Some are worse even than the November, fog plane, but it does no good to try to frighten people into goodness. The church tried out this method for centuries without success. Hence the decline in the popularity of hell, fire preaching. Whither is all this leading us? To a better understanding of the birthday message of Arthur Conan Doyle, when he said that to be cleared from astral ties was not altogether an easy matter. This was surely an understatement when it meant so great an act, so great a surrender, on his part. For at that moment he must have relinquished his promised Summerland of rest, refreshment and recreation which was his due after his strenuous years. Yet, in the Summerland life there is an element of forgetfulness, even of heedlessness of the cry of pain rising from men, that cry which hath no language but a cry. For Arthur Conan Doyle, there could be no forgetfulness, no lying down of his burden, no sealing of the heart. A new dedication, a new crusade was waiting to establish a new truth since the earlier truth for which he had formerly labored proved insufficient. Page 62. Therefore he said, in a broad sense the seeds of thought that he, man, sows are interpreted as actions, but now I find that thought is more powerful than action, since one of the first things a man is faced with on his escape from earth life is a world of his own thought. Consider these words in the light of what has been written about the astral planes, whereon man prepares for himself an abiding place by his own thought and feeling during his years on earth. He migrates to a world of his own thought, a self-constructed home or environment. One is reminded of the saying in the Bible, to the effect that whatsoever a man binds to himself on earth shall be bound to him in heaven, and whatsoever he shall loose from himself on earth shall be loosed from him in heaven. Here the same truth is conveyed again. To the world of our own thought which we go to inhabit, our sins and shortcomings will be grafted, but also the goodness that we do. It must be realized that this Arthur Conan Doyle communication was coming to us, not from a nestful world of people like ourselves, but from a source wiser, higher, purer, with a message far more powerful and enduring. This being so, what of the medium or instrument through which the message was to come? Surely the transmission of this message entailed some pains? Indeed, yes, for mine Esther had to forego much. It is true that the power and light of the wise knight made this contact possible, and was continually sustaining her. But that contact was a continually shattering experience. After the Bletchley meeting, she was exhausted for some days. What intensified the problem was that she was pledged to speak at or work for numerous spiritualistic centers, and the alternation between the astral contacts of the latter and with Arthur Conan Doyle meant the eventual abandonment of her work for organized spiritualism. One hesitates to say orthodox spiritualism, but it is the more accurate designation. After the meeting of the 22nd, the Polaires returned to France, and the other sitters to their homes. The task of obtaining the Arthur Conan Doyle message now rested with mine Esther and her three helpers, that is, with the square of four anticipated by White Eagle. On the whole, we shall find this square proved steady at its task during many months to come. Those who know White Eagle best are aware that he never comes without prayer, that he is always composed and leisurely, always dignified and serene. "Why hurry?" he says on occasion, "when you have all eternity before you." Perhaps this is why nobody has ever seen him ruffled, hasty or irritable, or heard him speak ill of any man. Only kind words pass his lips. This being so, the impetuosity with which Arthur Conan Doyle jumped in his haste to convince us that none other than he had spoken on May 22nd, was surprising, as was the assertion that he had been trying for days to get this confirmation through. He managed also to confirm the salient points of his message of the 22nd, although White Eagle had to help him time and again. It was obvious that Arthur Conan Doyle had much to learn before delivering his message, and that contrary to spiritualistic beliefs, communication between the worlds was proving a matter of much difficulty. Nearly a month had passed since the last meeting. "Arthur Conan Doyle, I have been trying for days to come through. Now let me thank all of you for your gallant help on my birthday. Be patient, I shall get stronger, I shall never give up, I shall stick to it, and this is what you two must do. Stick to our task. I am trying to attune myself again with the medium, and shall improve with practice. I desire to confirm that it was I who manifested at Bletchley on the day of my birth. I was trying with all my strength to let my dear ones know that I was there. You do not understand the difficulties we have in coming through." A spasm of coughing ensued. "All right, I shall overcome this. Wait," a pause of some moments. Then, "hold it, White Eagle. Hold it for me. I so want to do it." As we watched, we saw White Eagle's presence grow on the medium. Then followed White Eagle's invocation, "Great White Spirit of the open sky, the wide prairies and the quiet valleys, you who does dwell in the mighty places of the heavens, and does speak within the human heart as it waits on you in its quiet hours, O Spirit of truth and love, we come. We love you, O Father of love. May we deem it a gift of you that we are given opportunity of serving you by sacrifice of desire. O God, we pray for your power on our labors." White Eagle continued, "Our brother is very disturbed, very anxious to speak with you. It means so much to him that his new realization of truth should be made known. It means all the difference between heaven and hell. Finding these things are true, he must needs give them forth. It does not matter what opponents say. God will fight for him. He is out for the universal truth, out to spread those fuller truths which he has come back to bring. If you could but see from his present point of view of how little account is any human personality. Yet, since a well-known name may be used to bring this universal truth through into the hearts of men, insofar as the man Conan Doyle is concerned, let him be that channel. There are still many folk who cannot reconcile the teachings of spiritualism with the outworking of laws divine and immutable. When Arthur Conan Doyle Arrived on the spirit side of life, he found contact with the earth was not as easy as he had once thought. A great sea of astral memories tosses between the two aspects of life, and mediums can tap these unconsciously. He found that the one vital thing had been the inner and secret thought, life of his soul. All that he had ever thought now became his world. Thus, after death, the souls of men enter into a world which is really self-created, and their heaven reveals itself as that which was once within their secret heart. Bearing this fact in mind, much that has been accepted as evidence of survival and spiritual life is open to question. Real evidence can only be found in spiritual contact of heart with heart. Man has only power to see a spirit with his own quickening spirit. Evidence must be spiritually discerned or else may only consist of husks, mere figments, although there are of course exceptions to this rule. Arthur Conan Doyle's one desire is to make a statement which will eventually clear out of spiritualism all that is unreal and confusing. His soul is charged, and has clearer teaching to unfold, a glorious mission to fulfill. In the light of this teaching only will the memorial be built, for there can be no advance otherwise. The Conan Doyle Memorial is not in the hands of the spiritualists, as they are today, but is being watched over by the universal light. Until all are united in aim, they cannot advance. Yet the noble work wrought by Arthur Conan Doyle cannot be halted but must ever progress. Now that he has deeper knowledge of the after life and its conditions, he will still lead its advance. White Eagle was asked if he could obtain a clearer outline of what was to come. Arthur Conan Doyle then spoke. It is interesting to note the change in words and phrasing. Would that print could indicate the change in diction, manner, in the whole personality that now manifested. Arthur Conan Doyle, it all lies within these words. The kingdom of heaven is within. That is why I now see so clearly man's need for a master. In Christ you have all the secrets of life and death. He in his teaching, man must take up his cross and follow the light of love, for the cross symbolizes the crucifixion of all selfish aims and desires, the complete submission of the personal man to the impersonal love of God, the creator of all. This is the secret of life both here and hereafter. Man must live not for himself, not for his good name, nor to acquire personal power or prosperity, nor for success, but to contribute to the common good. In giving all, he receives all. Thus and thus only will he enter into the kingdom of heaven. Truly it is said that man must be born again, not of the flesh, but of the spirit. This means that he must die to self, that every man, whether incarnate in the body or discarnate, must eventually pass through a death of his mortal self, and awaken into new life, into a fuller and richer consciousness of the presence of the one all-loving God. Only thus will he find himself and find again those whom he loves. From this sphere of Christ consciousness descend all those whom you love, who have entered the spiritual life, and until you can raise yourself in spirit, attune yourself to their light, your power of communication with them must lack something most beautiful and pure. Consider the gulf that was fixed between the rich man and Lazarus, the bridgeless gulf which, after all, was of man's own creation. Yet there was still one way to cross that gulf, the way of love, but not, mark you, any personal or possessive kind of love, but rather the impersonal love of self, giving, self, forgetting, and self, sacrifice. Unless a man is born again, he can in no wise enter the kingdom of heaven. This is true indeed, yet there remain some souls which are still bound closely to earth, and which seek to regain contact with earthly things through the channels provided by mediumship. They too need showing the better way, for the veil between this world and yours is thin indeed compared to the severance between the earthly man, even when discarnate, and the real man of heaven. We make a mistake when we stress the importance of this, that or the other person, forgetting that there must always be mutual co-operation in the spreading of eternal truth. That is why I would prefer no personal reference in the memorial appeal, were this possible, since you are working not for a person but for a principle, for an ideal which will embody both the broad charity of the Christian teaching and the pure principles of Christ, or of the great white light of truth, it matters not whether interpreted through Buddha, Krishna or any other master. My wife will admit that I was a man of strong opinions out of which I was not easily persuaded. Nevertheless, spiritualism eventually compelled me to admit certain facts. I changed my mind again when I accepted the leadership of Jesus Christ in the movement of spiritualism. Again I changed concerning the after-death state. Surely, my friends would expect a man to have greater knowledge and clearer vision when freed from the limitations of the earthly tabernacle. Elsewhere would progress be? I am not prepared to say more at the moment. These things cannot be forced. I am content to leave them in the hands of God. This is the chosen instrument or channel for this special work, but another means will shortly be used to satisfy certainty and indeed made it possible. Mrs. Caird went many times afterwards to try to obtain a second picture of Arthur Conan Doyle, but in vain. It was again the Master's power which was lending life to this message from Arthur Conan Doyle, a power which originates from beyond astral realms and contacts, as we shall see later, by this photograph Arthur Conan Doyle. Signed, sealed and delivered his message of the 22nd. This was one proof, but not the conclusive proof which was to come later and, as M. Botiver said, would crash all critics, but substantial nevertheless. Chapter 10. You can see for yourselves, I am a happy man. People ask me what it is which makes me so perfectly certain spiritualism is true. That I am perfectly certain is surely demonstrated by the fact that I have abandoned my congenial and lucrative work and subjected myself to all sorts of inconveniences, losses and even insults in order to get the facts home to the people. Sir Arthur in a letter. At the next meeting on June 22nd, M. Botiver was again present. It will be noted that the group met when possible on the 22nd of a month, this being a day of power so far as the Arthur Conan Doyle work was concerned. White Eagle spoke fast. It may interest you to know that I was aware of this particular work before Arthur passed from the body. I already knew about it when I spoke to a group in Wales about 12 months ago. Miss Mary Conan Doyle and mine Esther were on holiday there, when I gave a good deal of information which will be valuable someday. Long after your own passing, this work will go onwards. Arthur Conan Doyle comes. He is so happy, now he speaks. Arthur Conan Doyle, cannot you see that by my old face in the picture? That is what you have produced. It is your power in this group which has sent to them, to his family, a message so that they will now know how I am feeling about things, and that I am a happy man. This you can see for yourselves in the picture. I want you to compare this impression of myself, which we were able to imprint on a photographic plate, with some of the spirit photographs received by others. I particularly want a close comparison, for this will teach you much. I want you to realize the difference between an astral impression and their real thing. For this is the very truth we are determined to make clear. There is so much humbug about these psychic things, largely unconscious, I admit, but what is needed is sane discrimination between the substantial and the nebulous type of proof. This is what spiritualism's critics, good men at heart, stand out for. You must help your people to discriminate between the real and the unreal. This does not lessen but will rather increase their strength to mount to a spiritual consciousness which will reveal reality. My mission is to indicate the difference between what is foolish and nonsensical, and what is a jewel of eternal truth. The truth will reveal heaven itself, the false will make a fool of man. So long as a man remains enmeshed in intellectual pride, he can never find truth. With this I am afraid some of my friends will disagree. Yet I must insist that, except a man become as a little child, he can in no wise enter the kingdom of heaven. I stress this again and again. A questioner. Will you define, except a man become as a little child? Arthur Conan Doyle. Except a man be stripped of all pride and egotism, except he realize that he is nothing without the power of Almighty Spirit, unless a man breaks out from the prison, house of arrogance to an understanding that of himself he can do nothing, he is dulled to the glories of heaven. Each soul must eventually be stripped of all possessions, whether of mind or heart, and stand forth naked, an infinitesimal nothing bathed in a vast ocean of universal knowledge and power.